Hello, welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius, your host. Today, I have a very interesting guest who has been diagnosed with dyslexia 54 years ago. He's been through five careers and is now an entrepreneur in the tech realm. And he started off in healthcare as a respiratory therapist, ended up as a teacher, as an assistant professor in Quinnipiac College. I hope I pronounced that right, and ended up in sales and marketing with Siemens in the medical realm, and eventually made his way into the life sciences realm and started his own tech-orientated company and became co-founder of BioTeam in 2002. And he's really interested in exploring shame and dyslexia. And I really want to explore this realm with Stan Gloss. Stan Gloss, it is great to have you here at Dyslexia Explored.
Yeah, Darius, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to sit down with another dyslexic and just hang out and talk. Yeah. and share our experiences. And, you know, today I've been recently reading some of the books from Brené Brown. And she is a PhD in social work. And most of her research is in an ugly topic called shame. And when I started reading this information, it just resonated with me that we don't, as dyslexics, really have conversations about the stigma and the way we feel about dyslexia and the shame that's associated with having it. Many people hide it for years and people don't want to talk about it. And so I thought having an open conversation about how this shame impacts us, what is it, where does it come from, and what could we do as dyslexics ourselves to help ourselves? And if we're parents, what can we do for our kids to help them grow into kids that can understand this shame and become resilient? Because I think it was Nietzsche who said that whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger. And it kind of feels that way. And I personally have gone from where dyslexia was a curse to me, and it lasted an awful long time. And I finally made my way into where I now feel dyslexia is a gift. And if there were a pill that could take away my dyslexia today, there would be no way I would ever take it, because I've just made that transition. The only thing I'm sad about is that it took me a long time to make that transition because of shame.
How long did it take for you to make this transition?
Yeah, so I was probably close to my 50th anniversary. So it was only like five or six years ago. So it almost took me 50 years to do this. Part of the way it happened was I read a book called The Dyslexic Advantage.
Great book.
And from that book, I was eye-opening to me. I nobody ever told me that there was an advantage to having dyslexia.
Yeah.
And then I started meeting other dyslexics and talking to other dyslexics. And that kind of experience ties back to, well, why did I wait so long? And most of it was because I was ashamed of being dyslexic, and I did everything I could, humanly possible, to hide it.
Tell us a bit about shame. I mean, Brené Brown's book, you know, sometimes it's useful to have a really clear understanding of what shame is.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the most powerful negative feeling that we have. Shame is this intense, painful feeling of believing that you're flawed. Mm. And therefore or you're unworthy of love, belonging, and connection.
Mm.
But when you have that, it is probably equivalent to some horrible physical pain. So when we activate our shame things, we can bully people, we can judge people, we can become completely silent, we can go inside, because what we try to do in shame is try to push it down. It's so emotionally painful that we try to hide it and push it down. And that's what I did for years. I never disclosed when I was, you know, getting jobs at places that I was dyslexic. It was never, ever something that I would speak about in jobs, at the jobs. I would try to do the best I could to compensate, but that created so much stress in working.
You know, I was just speaking to one of the students in our Bullet Map Academy club, and she was telling me that she would get really, really anxious in class.
Mm-hmm.
And she described this anxiety building up every time the teacher gave them a task in the class. The anxiety would build up, and it would just explode at the end of the day. Nearly every single day she'd have this anxiety attack. And I hear this with other children as well. You know, anxiety, they keep talking about anxiety just building up, meaning they can't sleep at night, they get so stressed and so on. And I'm just wondering, do you think there's a connection? I know we're being self-aware here. We're not experts in dyslexia. We're just dyslexics exploring and becoming self-aware. And this is the name of Dyslexia Explored. We're talking to people in the dyslexia from their dyslexic perspective or right. as parents or whatever, to hear people's stories. So do you think there's a link between shame and anxiety as well?
Well, shame, yeah, all of it is shame activated, whether it's anxious, whether it's aggression, whether it's, you know, there's all things that come. We do all kinds of things that are unhealthy, driven out of our shame. And examples for kids, when, you know, shame could be activated by kind of having the worst report card compared to your friends, because your friends, oh, let me see your report card and you got this. Or, you know, having to read in front of the class. That's another absolute shame-provoking activity, because, you know, you can, you know, get humiliated in front of people. And sometimes humiliation sets up shame, because you just, you know, it can be temporary, but if it's ongoing. So other things that can do it, writing at the blackboard. I mean, you get called up to the whiteboard, blackboard, whatever, to write, and you're doing a math problem. And your number fives look like S's, and things get flipped around and kids start laughing. I mean, you know, sometimes we have teachers who tell us that, and I hear this all the time, teachers who tell us to your face that you're either lazy, stupid, or you just don't try enough, or just being told that we're careless all the time. Those things are tough. Low SAT scores, which I had, you know, when you get a paperback marked up from a teacher and you've written in black ink and there's more red ink on the page than the black ink you used for the thing, that's pretty shame provoking. The other one that was really hard for me personally was the reading resource teacher used to come to my classroom to get me for my remedial reading session. So they said, oh, I'm here to get Stanley. And then you had to get up out of your chair, walk down the aisle. And that was definitely the walk of shame out of the room, because you were different. And kids just don't like to be different. Sometimes shame can also be provoked by, you know, if your parents don't have dyslexia and you do, because you may have gotten it from another relative, not directly from your parents, and you feel like you're disappointing them. You know, that can be.
I think that's very powerful. I mean, I haven't really used the language of shame or understood the word of shame in the way that you're talking about, and Brené Brown has so eloquently explained in all sorts of ways, and it's starting to penetrate our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Often, I think we use words like disappointment. I think one of the biggest things that I've battled with over the years is being a disappointment in school, disappointing my teachers, disappointing my parents, who are obviously trying really hard to help me, but not understanding why I can't just pull up my socks and do the basics of what's expected of me, just the basics. That feeling of disappointment. So that's tied in with shame as well, then, you know, like
it activates it. Yeah, it's there and it gets activated by words and actions and judgments. You know, ask my wife, you know, I classically start something on the countertop in the kitchen and then I think, oh, I need to go over here. And my mind moves to the next task without finishing the task that I'm on. Or I leave cabinet doors open. And, you know, this is still, you know, even though I've had a lot of experience with dyslexia, I'm still dyslexic.
Yes.
At the end of the day, I haven't grown out of it. I've learned to manage it better. But, you know, there's the upsides and downsides. You know, Brené Brown also talked about that when she interviewed 85% of the people in the public can recall an incident that happened in school that was shame related. So school shaming happens a lot. And I love this kind of metaphor that she talks about, is that these shame, when you get shamed like that, it creates creativity scars.
Oh, wow.
So I'll give you an example of, for me, one of my creativity scars. When I hand wrote papers for English, those were the ones that came back the reddest. And I was told that I wasn't a very good writer. And that literally has carried through with me as a scar and has left me with a fear of writing. But you could imagine any of these shaming events that happen could really, you know, make the situation, you know, whether it's artistic or whatever, it leaves its scar. And that's why it's so important that you and I have this conversation, because parents need to understand and help coach these and help kids understand it. And parents are wildly important. You know, a lot of the reason I'm talking today about my dyslexia is to honor my mother, who was my mentor and advocate for me. And if you talk to many successful dyslexics, you always find stories come back to mom. And a lot. I mean, the dads are great too. And, you know, my father was amazing, but he shamed me. I'll tell you the story. My father was an engineer and he used to help me. You know, if I had trouble in math, my father would help me in math. My mom helped me with English. But when I was doing the math problems wrong, my father classically said to me, "Wrong, guess again." And that tone actually gives you a negative reinforcement which helps build the shame that you can't do something, that you didn't know how to do it. You just guess, you're sitting here just guessing. So you're wasting my time. So my father was a wonderful man and a wonderful father, but I quickly learned not to do math homework with my father.
Yeah.
Because it was too painful.
It's interesting that you share that. You know, when I was at school, I went to a boarding school because I was so much trouble, really. And that was a last resort to try and whip me into shape. And I was at the bottom of all my classes, just totally out of my depth. The bottom of the back of every class, bottom of every class. Have you finished the blackboard yet, nom de ron? No, I haven't. Embarrassed constantly. But one day, I was doing maths homework. And we do maths homework as a group because it's a boarding school and the teachers supervise it. And this teacher who was supervising it was the upper middle school teacher, and he saw my maths. And he looked at the way I was doing my maths. And he looked at me and he said, "Nom de ron, I'm looking forward to when you come join my class because I think you're going to be very good at maths." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Oh, why? Why do you think I'll be good at maths, sir?" And he said, "Because you're lazy." And I said, "What?" And he said, "The best mathematicians are lazy. They want to find the fastest way to the answer. And look at the way you're doing maths here. You're trying to find the fastest way to your answer, aren't you?" And I was like, "I am." And he said, "That's what will make you good at maths. So I'm looking forward to having you in maths." And his name was Mr. Roland. Now, he was amazing with me. He kind of spotted me and said, "This child needs a little bit of help and I'll help him and encourage him." And he did. And in the maths class. But the interesting thing, so I think you've got a story about different people and how they can be significant in a dyslexic's journey. But here's an interesting scenario. He was an incredible encouragement to me, but I think he misunderstood something about me and it really hurt.
What
it was that I was incredibly fast at maths. Mm-hmm. I found it so satisfying to batter through all of these questions. And I got proud of it. It was the only thing I was really good at. Mm-hmm. And so when you did the questions, you would go up to the front, show him your section. He would tick, 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 and say you could go on to the next section. And I would race ahead and I would love it because it would be the only time I'd be ahead in the class ever. But I would get stuck on some of the simplest problems and I just get locked and I wouldn't understand why I can't figure this out. And there was something in him that kind of reveled in it a little bit. And I would go up to the table and say, "Sir, can you help me with this? I don't get it." And he'd go, "No, you're going to figure this out on your own. No, no, no." And what would happen is everyone would start racing ahead of me and I'd be left behind majorly, just locked in this loop and not being able to figure it out. I now know it was probably a dyslexic trait. I'd misunderstand something. I'd got in a loop and I needed some feedback. And that's why Mr. Roland was so useful for this feedback loop, to rapidly get feedback. And when the feedback stopped, I got blocked often. And I actually think, although he was an incredible help, but that was quite, if I use that language, I did feel ashamed in that. I felt deeply embarrassed by that and a bit mortified. Anyway, so similar kind of story.
Yeah, so interesting. In that same study of the 85% felt scarred in some way, 50% said that they also had a positive experience that somewhere along the line of the teacher was really came in and was the positive role model. And I mean, it was math and science.
Okay.
So there were two teachers, Dr. Tosselli, who was our science teacher. He was an optometrist and he was amazing. And he always believed in me. And then also Mr. Nimblett in math. It was the first A I ever got. And it was the only A I ever got from junior high all the way through high school. Wow. I never had an A in anything before. And I remember just jumping for joy of this. And, so that was kind of cool. But the person who really was, I think I want to talk about this concept of a charismatic, what we're talking about in the positive side is the charismatic adult. And that was a term coined by a Dr. Julius Siegel. And what charismatic adults are. A lot of times it's the parent, but it doesn't have to be. It's an adult who takes interest in a kid and sees them for their strengths and engages with them in a very positive and makes them feel like really unbelievable and really enabled. For me, that was my family doctor. So I wasn't very good at sports. So sometimes when I went home from school, I walked by his office and I just check in, say hello to him. He was my friend. And he loved that. And I used to sit on his lap while he stitched stuff. And we looked at x-rays, we looked under the microscope, and I would ask him, he would teach me all these amazing things. And he made me feel so good. And I had left school, which was demoralizing. But then I interacted with an amazing adult who made me feel and reminded me that I was really good. So I have a story of one of my friend's daughter is dyslexic. And she went into a pharmacy and she was walking down the aisle and saw a little girl crying in the aisle. She walked up to her and said, like, what's wrong? So she was standing in front of the nail polish and she was holding a little bottle of nail polish and she was crying. She says, what's the problem? She says, I can't read this word and I can't pronounce this color. And she said, it's the color aqua. And certain words for dyslexic, no matter if we, there's things that we can't read and there's certainly things I can't spell. I still to this day say, okay, how do I spell this word? And thank God for Siri, because I asked Siri, I now replaced my wife for Siri. I'm cheating on her. So she's no longer helping me with spelling anymore because I can just ask Siri how to spell things, which is great use of technology. So she told us she was dyslexic. And then my friend's daughter said, I'm dyslexic too. And you'll be okay. And it was literally a 5-minute conversation. And she had a necklace. My friend's daughter had a necklace on that said the word believe. And she took it off her and put it on the girl and said, you're going to be amazing and all that. That 5-minute encounter, she got 6 months later a letter handwritten from the mother saying that you literally changed my daughter's life. She used to be very quiet in class and now she's a leader and all of this. So we can be, adults can be game changers if they focus on the child's strength and being supportive and really kind of connecting to this idea of the charismatic adult.
This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices.
What you're talking, I think what you've taught me is that empathy is the antidote to the poison of shame, the venom of shame. I love that phrase. Is that a Brené Brown phrase or is that yours?
Well, it's kind of my interpretation of her work.
Yeah, because thinking of shame as a venom injected into you and then this antidote is empathy, and that charismatic leader that is also empathetic is kind of what you're talking about there, isn't it? Could you talk a bit more about the power of empathy in this sort of relationship, in this role?
Well, it's kind of funny because the thing is that when we talk as dyslexics amongst ourselves, we provide that empathetic walking in the other person's shoes.
Yeah.
That we don't even have to explain it to each other.
Yeah.
We just naturally in there. And you think about many different support networks and support groups. There's Alcoholics Anonymous and then all of those 12-step programs. A lot of them are put together from people who've had similar experiences. So there is something to providing that level of empathy to address the underlying shame that's causing a behavior that's getting us not productive. And this, and so, you know, we can, unfortunately, not knowing and thinking about empathy, we can make some pretty bad mistakes and miss, and it's called an empathy. So if we're not, if we don't understand what empathy is, we could actually see a situation where we have an opportunity to be empathetic, but we end up doing something wrong. And what we end up doing is having the person or the child walk away from us, compounding the shame. So we don't want shame. So if we get it wrong, we can actually make the situation worse.
So could you define, could you help the listeners kind of clarify what you mean by empathy? What is empathy?
So it's really, really getting deeply connected to the feelings of another person. So the biggest misconception people don't, the average person doesn't understand, is the difference between sympathy and empathy. We think that we're helping the person when we're sympathetic, but we may not be. We may actually be making them feel worse through sympathy. So sympathy is connecting to an experience.
Okay,
and I'll give you examples. Empathy is connecting to feelings. So for instance, a lot of times when people pass away, what kind of card do you send? Sympathy card. And that sympathy card is associated where I'm sorry you lost a loved one. That's an experience. And that's focused on, I'm sorry. And you feel better because you said to the person who's grieving you that you're doing this, right?
Yeah.
Empathy is taking your own personal experience and talking about the feeling of loss, not the actual loss. It's the feeling and connecting at a feeling level. Because when a person is really triggered with shame, it's all driven out of feelings. So you have to get to the feeling level. And if you do the feeling levels, if you do that right, you can extract the venom. If you do it wrong, you can inject it more. So sometimes we can have, I have a couple examples of miscues of what would create a miscue. So, you know, your child comes to you and tells you this thing and you say, you did what? Oh, too bad. That's too bad. Well, that's not connecting with empathy. And now you're just validating that this is too bad, or gee, that's kind of disappointing. That kind of comment, when you say it, is telling the kid or the other person that you actually let them down, because you're now revalidating that's disappointing, and it's disappointing to you, and it's also disappointing to the other person. So that doesn't help at all. Here's another one that goes on. You're not stupid. They are. And all you're doing is shifting the blame of how that person feels to somebody else. But you're not healing. You're not extracting the venom out. You can also say, oh, I hear you, but it's not that bad. Well, now you're downplaying somebody's feeling, and that's not helpful. The other one that parents, this is a classic parent one. You know, when I was your age, you know, this, I took care of this problem, and, you know, I was this, and I walked through snow, and I dealt with these things. Making comparisons also. So
I'm guilty of that. I am so guilty of that with my daughter with dyslexia. And I think, gosh, that's got to be a very big trap for us, especially dads. I mean, first of all, if you're male, we tend to be more project orientated, more task orientated. right, let's fix this for you. Yeah, I've come across this problem before. This is what I did. This is how to sort it out, etc. And I'm very much like that as a person. And I think men often, dads veer to that side often more as well.
Yeah, so Brené Brown talks about five skills, and I'm going to review these skills with you.
Okay.
That you do, because we may not naturally be empathetic.
Yeah.
But we all have feelings, and we all can tap into a feeling. So you may not have ever had a loss or a person die in your family that you've experienced, but you may have lost your bike. You may have lost something. We all can connect to a feeling. We may not share the exact same experience. So if we're talking about shame, or the person comes to you and says they're humiliated, well, you didn't do the same thing to get humiliated that that person did with you, but you could have, you know, perhaps, you know, tap into some experience in some place where you felt equally. So let's go through the skills. So the first skill is to see the world as your child sees it, from their putting things into their perspective. So everybody has glasses that they see their perspective in. And the rule is, you can't change your glasses. So you have to try to see it from the other person's glasses, not your own. You'll get miscues, and you'll have those others, things that I told you not to do, those miscues, where you'll make things work when you try to do things from your own perspective. So first, you have to kind of see it from your child's perspective. The second thing is, you need to be curious, and you need to be non-judgmental. Because if you don't do it right, and you provide judgment at that point, you're going to further hurt the situation.
Yeah.
So, and the only way to stay non-judgmental is to ask questions. So as an adult and somebody who's trying to help being empathetic to another person, you have to remember, in this situation, you're the learner. You're there to learn. You're not there to teach.
Yeah.
And that, you know, discovering through that asking questions, you want to discover what is the feeling. Now, the hard part about discovering feelings for people is, if you yourself can't connect to your own feelings, it's going to be hard for anybody to connect to another person's feeling. So you have to be clear of your own, getting connected to your own feelings.
One of the things that I've noticed in all of the podcasts I've done, John Hicks comes to mind, actually. If you go to John Hicks' podcast, we'll put the link in the description below. When he's a dyslexia blogger in the UK, he tells the story of his daughter being identified with dyslexia. And actually, the biggest challenge he faced was for him, and all the emotions it started to bring up, awake up, that were pushed down and hidden. And that makes me think, you know, I mean, I'm seeing this with, you know, this journey of helping other dyslexic children with bullet mapping and organizing their ideas visually, you know, triggered like so many people in the dyslexia world by their own child's experience and starting to help other children. When I'm starting to realize that a lot of those memories have just been buried, and a lot of those feelings have been buried because they're so painful. Mm-hmm. And it seems embarrassing to say that, you know, the way teachers looked at you, the way they talked at you, the way that, you know, being told by your teacher that you're retarded when you're 7, 6 years old, you know, and not understanding what they mean. that's what they said to my parents, for example. My head teacher brought them in. And often it's the way people look at you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I think isn't often shared much. It's not even just what you say. It's that look where they look at you and go, what are you talking about? That's weird. You're strange. You're whatever. And it's this confused look or a disappointed look from parents or teachers. Don't even need to say anything. When you experience that day after day after day, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 times a day, every lesson, etc., that compounds. And I think, and I'm talking personally, I probably just bury it. And you don't want to experience that pain again.
Right.
To be empathetic. Do you know what I mean? And I have to be honest with you, like, yesterday, I think I spent quite a bit of the afternoon crying for joy, but also pain, because I met a student of mine who had this utter transformation in school because she had learned mind mapping and could organize her thoughts visually and keep up with the rest of the class. But what she described was these daily stress explosions and the anxiety it cost and the spiral she was in, and she had got out of that, and she was like getting 98% for an English essay. Mm-hmm. And the joy she had on her face, it was just quite remarkable. And I was really happy, tears of joy. But I also started to feel the pain of that anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts to wake that back up in you, you know? So it is a little bit of a challenge to be empathetic, isn't it?
Well, I mean, first, you know, like for us, if, you know, Brené Brown says, if you don't claim shame, shame claims you.
Wow.
But so, and the thing is that it claims us in many ways. So if we don't address the issue of shame, kids are going to find a way to cope with it in many different ways, and some of them not good. Some of them will turn to drugs and alcohol just to kill the pain.
Yeah.
They will find ways to do that, and there's a significant amount. And, you know, kids who have no advocates and no positive role models and all that, you know, there was the artist Chuck Close, famous quote is, dyslexics either go to Yale or they go to jail, because the prison population has 30 to 40% of it kids with dyslexia. There's a significant number that get incarcerated, you know. So what do we need to do is we need to find ways to help our children become resilient. Cause if they can get, I failed so many times. I failed more times in the first 12 years of school than the average person will fail in a lifetime. And I believe that my journey as a dyslexic was critical in my success as an entrepreneur. So overcoming adversity, having role models, having mentors, you know, if we want, Robert Brooks wrote a book on the resilient child. And if you want to, that's an important book to read for a parent, because what we really want to build in our children is resiliency. We cannot take dyslexia away from anybody, but we can work with them to become more resilient. So it's not that we're going to fall down. It's about how we get up.
Yeah.
And so some of the things, setting realistic goals.
Okay, so what number are we on? So that you were going to share 5 things. Could you recap them a bit?
Go to the next one. Empathy skills. Yeah, we'll go back over. So first, seeing the world from your the way your child sees it. 2, be curious. Don't judge. Ask questions so that you become the learner. 3, which is discovering what they feel, discovering the feeling and lock into that feeling. Mm-hmm. And when you get on it, share a time as a parent, I had that same feeling too. And then finally, the fifth one is being thoughtful and mindful about the situation.
I think the feeling was the third thing, wasn't it? Did we miss
feeling
one?
Was the third thing. And then the fourth thing is, first you identify their feeling.
Okay.
And then four, you connect your feeling to their feeling so that they feel like, okay, just like you and I are connecting as dyslexics, now we're going to connect. Both of us have had disappointments.
Yes.
I want to share some time when I also feel that way. So I'm going to connect with you. And the key thing is also to stay mindful of the situation, that don't let your emotion get triggered from their emotion.
Mm.
So what you want to do is you want to stay calm. You want to stay focused on their feeling. You're providing the empathy. Remember, you're giving the, you know, anti-venom to them. You're treating the patient. And you want to stay focused. Sometimes that in these situations, a parent could get triggered themselves. And then their shame comes up. And now you got a shame storm. And nobody's winning. Now you've just infected two people with the virus. And now it's not going to go well. So we've got to stay in the feeling, associate that feeling, and then keep asking the questions. Sometimes when people are not comfortable with getting to their feeling level, what they'll do is they will start to offer solutions quickly.
Yeah.
And here, yeah, what did you think about this? Did you think about that? Did you know?
Yeah.
And we get off the feeling, and we're not dealing with it. And it's because we ourselves are not comfortable with connecting with feelings. That's why it's critically important to stay until the child feels, do you feel better at the end? Do you, you know, is this helping you get this? And you want to let them learn to process out loud. And let them talk it out. And the only way they're going to talk it out is if you retain your position as the learner. You're learning about their feeling and what's driving that feeling, and stay right on it. And don't get distracted around things. And don't try to, we all want to solve the problems, but we help our children in the end when we can provide. So I understand. Does this sound like I understand your problem? Yeah. Okay, did you think maybe you could look at this? You know, so I'll give you an example from myself. So sometimes I feel like I can't enjoy my own successes because I always need help from somebody. If I want to write something, I have to have an editor. If I want to do something who has a skill that I don't have or something I'm not good at, I'm always kind of, I never can have my own success. It's always shared. Well, you could look at that as a negative, which I do sometimes, or you can reframe it and put up from a different perspective. All of a sudden, wow, you're really resourceful. It's not that when the kid comes to you and say, I can't do anything myself, and this and that, and you go, well, but did you get the job done? And you used all the available resources around you? That's pretty clever. So help as parents, helping show children that there are other perspectives and get them to learn to look for different perspectives is a beautiful gift that we can give our children as adults who care so much. Helping them learn how to talk out their problems and keep asking questions. So what would you do in the next time you have this situation? What would you do? And just not try to solve the problem for your child. Try to help guide through questioning your child to get to the solution and be able to get there. I think is the most powerful thing we can do to help undo the shame, get to those feelings that are driving the shame, and then allowing our children and friends and colleagues and others to really do that. I mean,
so could you close this loop by saying, we talked about shame, we talked about the empathy that neutralizes this shame. Let's talk about the reward that comes from moving into experiencing empathy or giving empathy. What's the benefit? What would you say you've seen over the last 5 years since you've been exploring neutralizing shame? What have you experienced as the benefit of taking on this challenge, really?
Right. So relieving of the shame is a very empowering thing. It you know, speaking it out, being able to, one, I would have never been on this podcast talking about what I'm doing. So having the self-confidence and freedom, shame is a tremendous burden.
Mm.
And relieving that burden allows you to open up and heal those scars.
Mm.
And now I feel like I can take more chances of being more creative and, you know, what's the worst thing that's going to happen, you know?
Like you're writing a book, for example, right now.
Like taking on writing a book.
Well, you were talking about that creative scar from all that writing, and now you've done this shame thing, and now you're writing a book about entrepreneurship in the STEM world.
Yeah, so that's a good example of what you can get. Because all of these things, shame holds us back from being our best. Shame stops us from taking chances because we're afraid of activating the shame. But when you relieve that shame, you then have all of the gifts of dyslexia at your disposal to use. Mm. And that's the limit of what we can do with this beautiful mind that we've been given. So I don't know. I just, like I said, once I figured I wasn't cursed and I was gifted, now there'll never be a time where I ever don't want to be dyslexic. I actually, you know, when I one of my stories that I tell is that, you know, when I was younger, I always wanted to have a divorce from dyslexia.
Oh, yes.
I wanted to divorce dyslexia from me because I hated dyslexia. And but now I'm living with a beautiful marriage of who I am, and dyslexia is a absolutely amazing partner. And getting to that point, it took a journey, but conversations like you and I are having right now are going to make sure that kids and adults don't have to wait 50 years for the cure.
Yeah, absolutely.
They can get the cure sooner and live a longer, happier time, shame-free.
Yeah. And unlock that potential, that creative potential, dyslexic potential that is in there, often being held back by the shame.
Yep. And that's...
So, in summary, Stan, let's wind up this podcast. We've got to get you back for another podcast to talk about other stuff as well, because there's so much you've got to share. We'll do another one. But let's summarize what we've talked about here. I've heard you say, you know, dyslexia, you know, we can have these experiences that start to inject shame into our lives. Sometimes we don't necessarily call it shame. We experience this feeling of disappointment or inadequacy, incompetence, etc. But those are really the fruits of shame that's deeper down. And that shame can lock us out from being honest and open with other people. And each one of those can be a creative scar. And then some charismatic person comes along, parent, an individual who is empathetic connects with, understands you, sees you, connects with that feeling, shares some of their equivalent feeling, but not, oh, I've been through that sort of thing, but the feeling of it, I know how you feel, and then questioning and helping that person come out of that situation starts to heal those creative scars. And once mm-hmm. those creative scars start to heal, the potential, the gifts that are dormant in there start to release and get unlocked, and you start to transform, go from curse to blessing, as it were, from curse to the gift of dyslexia.
Absolutely. No, exactly right. But this is a topic that I've never heard actually discussed. So it was really important. And again, books, if you listen, Brené Brown's book on the gift of imperfection is wonderful. And Dare to Lead are the two books that I read of hers that really go into this in great detail. And, you know, I would highly recommend it. I mean, it was so, it resonated so much with me that I felt the urge to come on to this podcast and share. And the funny thing is that it's really amazing to me that I actually now quote books.
Yes, it is, isn't it? That's great.
Hey, have you read this book? I mean, it's like, I can't even believe I say that.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
I hated reading. And maybe one time we'll come back and talk about assistive technologies.
That would be great, because you are extremely dyslexic. I mean, there's dyslexic and there's dyslexic. You know, like I would say some people are mildly dyslexic and it still has a massive impact on their life. No doubt about that. Then there's moderately dyslexic people, which is me. And then there's extremely dyslexic people like you. And actually, the interesting thing is that there's a different experience between mild dyslexia, moderate dyslexia, and extreme dyslexia. And often, for example, I'm more moderate in my dyslexia. And so I can do some things. I can read now. I can operate without tech and assistance and so on. But what ends up happening is I start thinking I have to do everything on my own. And actually, I haven't really learned that gift of delegation. And often that's a trait of mild to moderate dyslexics. Whereas sometimes I wish I was more dyslexic like you and Branson and so on, because you have to delegate often. I mean, you delegate to assistive tech in terms of reading people, your books out to you and people who do things for you.
Yeah, so I'd love to come back and share some of those stories, and you know, maybe someday we can do a call-in show where we have a whole bunch of parents and then do that, something like that together again. So who knows? But I think it would be wonderful to come back and do another one with you, because again, I want to take whatever I've learned and share it back so that it streamlines another person's time. I don't want people to travel the same path I did. I want them to travel it faster.
So let's definitely do that. So we basically talked about how to help dyslexia from the inside, and that's dealing with that shame, that root of shame. And then in the next podcast, we'll talk on a much more comfortable level, which is how to deal with dyslexia from the outside with assistance and tech and delegation and strategies and so on, which is still needed to do it. So yeah, great. Let's do that, Stan. It's been really great to have you on this podcast. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure and honor. And, making sure that all of our friends in the club are well informed.
Yes, that's right. As early as possible. Ideally when they're children. We're actually thinking about starting Dyslexia Explored for Kids. Mm-hmm. So a little podcast where kids who are dyslexic start to interview other dyslexic people and start exploring these little things. And it would be fascinating to have kids asking the questions, wouldn't it?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get them on. I love talking to kids.
That would be great, actually. That would be fantastic. So we could have like a Q&A, ask me anything type thing with parents around this topic. And then we could have one just with kids. I've got 96 kids in my Bullet Map Academy. Do you know one of the things we do is that it's interesting is, and I do this intuitively, and having heard this, I realize we get the children together for what we call study clubs. And the children get together and they talk through their maps, their work in school, they talk through it, and then they share what they like about each other. The golden rule is you only share what you like and nothing else. You don't correct them, you don't teach each other or anything. You just learn to share what you like. And what's fascinating is they start talking about their dyslexia, they start understanding the way each other. Some children stumble through what they're talking through, and everyone sits there and listens and totally understands. And there's that. I think what I've learned is we're intuitively finding we need that support group, and finding that support group for 5 or 6 kids at a time at different times and so on, that the heart of that actually is empathy. And I'm just realizing that that is what it's eliciting.
Exactly right. So us as parents working, having a parent group, is we're providing the empathy because they have shame as well.
They do.
Because the child is labeled dyslexic or disabled, learning disabled, and they get that label pinned on them. And now the perfect child that everybody wanted is now. I had a situation with my mom where a woman who was like a special ed person described my brain like a sweater with a defect in it.
Oh no.
And my mother felt horrible that, you know, we were, it's like a imperfection of a stitch, a drop stitch or something like that. And it's like, his brain's always just gonna have that defective. It's just gonna be a defective one, but it's only a small defect. And it's like, no, that's not it. It's not the way it works.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's so much that we learn and do that, you know, affects this stuff. So
Stan, thank you very much for being here. Thank you for opening our eyes to shame and the power of empathy. Thank you very much, Stan.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This podcast is sponsored by DyslexiaProductivityCoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to DyslexiaProductivityCoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.